Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for grabbing the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, I'm joined by science journalist and author Suzanne Bowen, a woman I've known since the 1980s when we worked together in San Francisco radio.
Things could be lazy if they were so crazy, and I wasn't following you.
Our conversation explores Suzanne's new book called 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier, and How to Challenge Inequality. Now, we do focus on the problems, but our conversation is mostly about some innovative solutions that have been working here in California that empower people who haven't really been given power and that address some of the deepest pathologies, including gun violence and health inequities. I think you'll find this interesting and maybe even a little uplifting. Might provide some roadmaps to activism for you. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including Cheryl Fleming, Teresa Paris, and on the left coast in Eureka, Billy Cook is a staunch supporter. On the east coast of Maine, Dick Atlee kicks in $5 every month from his retirement. Thank you, Dick. You can join them too. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber, and all the details are right there on the sign-up page.
You've got a lot to learn about it too.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the Peter B. Collins Podcast.
About me too.
My guest today is marine author and science journalist Suzanne Bowen. Her new book is called 20 Years of Life, and it's a fascinating look at some of the most serious social problems we face and some of the creative solutions that are being advanced, particularly in recent years. Suzanne, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
I think I should disclose that I've known you for a long time. We first met working in San Francisco radio way back in the 1980s.
That's right. I was a traffic reporter, and you were the anchor at KRQR.
Yeah. And then you went to Stanford, where you got your master's degree in journalism.
Right.
And you worked for the Bay Area Newspaper Group, which includes the IJ here mm-hmm. in Marin, mm-hmm. Contra Costa Times, Oakland Tribune, Mercury News. Mm-hmm. And you spent about 12 years there
right.
on the science beat.
Right, because I have an undergrad in biology also. I decided rather than getting a journalism undergrad, I would get a science degree and then get a master's in journalism. Mm-hmm.
Well, it has served you well. And one of the series that won you and another reporter an important award from the White House Correspondents Association helps inform the underpinnings of your new book. And that series was called Shortened Lives, Where You Live Matters. Tell our viewers a little bit about how you were able to track, almost to the zip code level, how the incidence of serious illness, shorter life expectancy, and other medical health environmental issues have severe impacts on that population.
Well, we had the help of the director of public health for Alameda County, Dr. Tony Iton, who had an epidemiologist track by zip code life causes of death in Alameda County. And so he lent us an epidemiologist to also get Contra Costa County data, which didn't exist at that time. So we studied both of those counties. And based on that, we found the zip code with the longest life expectancy, which was in Walnut Creek. And then the lowest life expectancy, which was Sobrante Park, which is a really tough neighborhood in Oakland, and the gap was 16 years. And you saw that pattern throughout. And what I also did is I found the middle one in this, because this tracks along the income gradient, really. It really tracks to, there's several factors, but the closest proxy is income. So middle class also dies sooner. They were dying about 8 years on average less than the wealthier area. So I went into the showing, we showed their lives, what it's like living in the poor, the middle class, and the wealthy. And really, as I point out in my book as well, it all ultimately drills down to the toll of chronic stress. That when you're constantly activating this powerful stress response, it gets out of whack, and you get these powerful hormones in your system, cortisol and so on, that cause this myriad of reactions throughout your body. Plus, there's difficulty accessing healthy food. You don't feel safe getting exercise. Nobody dreams of going to a park if you even have one in these poor neighborhoods. So there's all these factors that conspire against those in the lower incomes from making healthy lifestyle choices. But what's also interesting is the middle class still has shorter lives, but they didn't have unsafe neighborhoods. They had access to grocery stores. So that was a really clear indication of the role of chronic stress, because they were feeling job insecurity, layoffs pending, debts, and that kind of thing.
And education is a critical driver of health issues, largely because it will determine what your income level will be, and that in turn drives where you can live.
Correct. Right. Yeah, and also there's some degree of health literacy and understanding choices and being able to make better choices, but it definitely is mostly income. That's correct.
So I want to start with your coverage of Richmond, and I'm promoting your book today, but Steve Early has written a great book about the dramatic changes in Richmond over the last 15 years called Refinery Town. And he takes a look more at the politics of Richmond. And I would submit that that is an important factor in the turnaround, because Richmond was one of the most deadliest communities, both in terms of gun violence and in health outcomes. And dramatic changes have occurred. And we're going to talk about some of the community-driven programs that were very effective there. But I also think there was a critical change in the political outlook, and that when Gail McLaughlin, the Green Party mayor at the time, took on the Chevron company, I think that it set a tone that change is possible, and that we don't have to accept that the status quo yesterday is what things are going to be like tomorrow, if not worse.
Right. It's an empowered community. It's getting more and more empowered. And people are understanding in Richmond that they can organize and collectively make big changes. And something like that is a huge example. And also the leadership of her and others has also led to the hiring of a city manager who's quite progressive and risk tolerant. Whereas so many city managers are just concerned about playing it safe and not taking risks. And he has taken, Bill Lindsay, I write about him in the book. So he is the one, as well as the city council, who is approving the budgets for these, you know, really innovative programs that I write about in there. They're supporting a risk-taking approach and one that involves a lot of community input. So it all works together. So, yes, it paves the way for that.
And the police chief, whose name I can't summon right now, also has adopted many progressive policies and I think changed the composition of the department in ways that are very positive. But take us to the Iron Triangle. This is described by Tudie Maher in your book as an area that was characterized as the seventh most violent neighborhood in the United States.
Right.
And there's this park called the Elm Playlot that was where druggies and gang members were hanging out. And during the time of extreme gun violence, many of the people in that neighborhood would not use the park because of who was already there and just the general risk of going outside.
Right, right. When she first saw it, Tootie made a lot of money in business and decided she wanted to focus on creating a park in an area where kids did not have access to one. She was very athletic growing up, and she actually overcame some physical difficulties growing up, so she wanted to make sure everybody had the opportunity to be athletic. So she cruised around, and then she spotted this one. She saw men hanging out at a picnic table. She saw pit bulls. There was the swings were all chewed up because they would pit bulls would practice on them. And she went and knocked on a neighbor's door and said, I'm thinking of fixing that park up. And the woman said, hold on a second, came out with two buckets full of shards of glass that she had to sweep up from the park to have a birthday cake for her son on the picnic table. So, and most of the houses were boarded up facing it. And there was a drug house that was causing all this issue. So Tootie decided to take that on. And she's subsequently, as I describe in the book, brought in $16 million in funding, mostly from the state through a state parks grant and a transportation funding to create that park and another one. There's now 70,000 kids visiting it a year. It's just this joyful place. And what she did that so pioneered this new model, nobody's done it, and hopefully others can replicate it, but she got a sole source contract. That's kind of complicated, but she had to be able to, and this is where Bill Lindsay and the city government supported her, not having to put this out to bid, where some contractor 50 miles away would get the bid, the lowest bid, and then build it and then disappear and it all falls apart. So she was able to get a sole source contract so she could control the renovation of it. And then she hired locals, all the people living around there who knew the park and knew all the gang members and so on, and trained them in skills in design and construction. And so all these locals are deeply invested in it. And people stay away. They respect it. They're not going to mess with their auntie's, you know, project. And so that's the genius of it. And she's put in hundreds of thousands of dollars of wages into the community and created a staffed park where people feel safe and kids are just thriving in the area. And it's changed the neighborhood.
Yeah. And let's talk about this program called Operation Peacemaker. It's the Operation Peacemaker Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 90s, Elihu Harris was the mayor of Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with him one day, and he said, you know, there's a finite number of these gangbangers and drug dealers. And he said, if we can just lock them all up, we're going to eliminate most of the problem. And I said, Mr. Mayor, I don't agree with that, because I think that for the most part, the day after you send one dealer to prison, he's going to be replaced by one, if not two others.
Right.
And you have to deal with underlying issues, and you have to change behavior. So with that in mind, Richmond took a very different approach, and they went directly to the people who were the most likely suspects for future gun violence, people who may have just gotten out of prison, people who had been involved in gangs or drug dealing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a remarkable effort combined with, you know, a myriad of efforts to fix the most serious problems in Richmond. And the bottom line is that in the last 10 years, gun violence in Richmond has been reduced by 71%.
Correct. Injuries and deaths from gun violence. It's incredible. And yes, it's an Office of Neighborhood Safety is the program I describe in there, where the director, the then director, Devon Bogan, identified, with the help of police and law enforcement, 70 active shooters causing most of the problem. And they decided to drill down on recruiting them. And they actually finally at that point, and then I think they refined it down, but they identified like 30 or 25, and then they invited them to City Hall to have a lunch and to treat them like dignitaries and important economic development people, because in fact they were affecting the economic outcome of the city, as he said. Three of them died before that lunch was held, but the remaining 23 did come. I want to back up just a little bit to that. There's an overarching campaign behind all this work that I'm reporting on, which is what's called the Building Healthy Communities Campaign. And the California Endowment, which is the state's largest health foundation, is backing it. And they took a chance in 2010 to invest all of their grant making, which is about, they have $4 billion in assets, but they give out about $200 million a year in grants. And they focused almost all of it on 14 distressed communities, Richmond among them, yeah, and these others, and to building up political power and community organizing in these areas. So these are all the fruits of that work. And in the case of POGO with Elm Playlot and Devon Bogan's ONS program, Office of Neighborhood Safety, they did early funding when nobody else would touch them. So they gave sort of catalytic funding, and they saw the promise of these. So this is about funding change, not charity. And this ultimately, the book is a message in many ways to not only individuals about the power you can possess if you collectively organize to change your neighborhood, but also to philanthropy. That just starting another program that disappears when the services are all given out or the funding stream dries up. But this creates lasting change by creating a political infrastructure and changes the culture. Just like what you're talking about is happening in Richmond because of the Chevron win and so on.
And the combination of showing respect to these individuals where they become fellows in this program.
Right.
And under certain circumstances, they can earn monthly payments.
Correct.
And some people characterize that, oh, you're paying people not to shoot other people. But in order to change behavior, you have to address the economic disparity that often leads people into participating in the drug black market or becoming a criminal because that's the best way they know to support themselves.
Right.
So by providing meaningful alternatives that are directed, you know, it's not just saying, here, don't shoot anybody and come back next month.
Right.
You talk about how some of these mentors were talking to their fellows, their clients, three or four times a day.
Right. Right. Yeah, it is very much about respect. It's finding the humanity even in the lethal shooters. And this this stipend, they get a stipend of up to $1,000 a month, and it's up to 9 months they can earn it. But not all of them get $1,000 a month. But they have to reach certain goals, like attending an anger management class or financial management class or getting their GED. And what it really is based on cognitive behavioral therapy, where when you get a reward for a behavior, you begin to reinforce that behavior. So it's not about rewarding them for not shooting. It's about rewarding them for evolving, internally. And so it's been incredibly effective. And also, for a lot of these young men, it's the first real affirmation they've been getting. And a reward for good behavior.
And some of them get travel opportunities. Mm-hmm. These are people who may never have crossed a bridge.
Right, right.
And they get to ride an airplane and go to Disneyland or New York or something like that.
Right.
And that kind of experience, I just have to feel is so affirming and helps people create personal visions beyond the limited bubble that they have lived with.
Correct. I mean, they've been staking their lives on this postage-sized stamp of territory, and then they travel to South Africa or to D.C. or Paris, and they have a different view, and they're also sharing the same seats with people they were trying to kill, and they have a whole new appreciation for each other when this is all over, so they have a new respect for each other. So it's powerful, and it is replicating. Sacramento just adopted the program. Stockton is soon, if they haven't already. So the whole program, again, with this early sort of support and certainly other forms of support, is replicating.
Suzanne, there's a part of your book that really surprised me. Mm-hmm. I follow the news very carefully. Mm-hmm. I pay attention to what's going on in Sacramento in terms of legislation. And I completely missed this whole period of time when people made, both legislators and some of the top philanthropists, like at the Cal Endowment, aware that one of the serious issues producing what was characterized or seen as a high dropout rate was that zero tolerance tolerance policies, cops on campus, and efforts to control the classroom led to a massive spike in suspensions, expulsions, and other disciplinary actions, particularly those that are based on the vague notion of defiant behavior, willful defiance by the student.
Right.
And this is a category kind of like material support for a terrorist group that could cover almost anything, right?
Right.
I sent a stamp to bin Laden, and therefore I'm a criminal. But, you know, the hierarchy in education and in government was very slow to respond to this because we've been conditioned that we've got to weed out bad people, that zero tolerance is the way to establish, you know, firm disciplinary grip. But the unintended consequences were that in some years there were more people being disciplined heavily in school than were graduating.
Right, more suspended than being graduated in California.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this campaign, this BHC, Building Healthy Communities campaign, unearthed that. And how they did it was in these 14 communities, they started a listening campaign, the top leadership. And they went around, and it emerged in Fresno first, where there was just outrage among students, the young people, and their parents about overly harsh school disciplines. They were kicking their kids out of school, and the parents were really fearful for their children's future, understandably. And it was mostly, it was disproportionately Black and Hispanic. And
well, I jotted down Blacks are 31% more likely to be disciplined than whites.
Correct. So what happened, again, I'll keep going back to the campaign because it is structured in such a way that it's unearthing this and it's giving voice to people who never had voice. So finally, they heard it and they're like, okay, let's look a little deeper. And that's when they found that statistic because there was some national work going on. But the bottom line is they worked with some researchers out of USC. And they found that statistic that they were suspending more kids than they were graduating in California in 2009, I believe it was. And then they were off and running. They realized there was a problem. And subsequently 11 laws have been passed that are directly attributed to the work of this campaign because they funded ad campaigns and consultants and all these.
But there was resistance from the governor and from many Democrats who we would assume are likely to be more progressive.
Correct. Because they didn't want to infringe on the right of teachers to discipline and run their classrooms as they wished. And teachers' unions have long been supporters of Democrats. But the first batch of bills passed, the teachers' union was actually distracted by some other ballot initiatives, so they figured there was no opposition. Mm-hmm. But subsequently, the bottom line is they're not even done yet. They're continuing on this, but they've passed 11 laws reducing suspensions and expulsions. It's now down 50% in California. Mm-hmm. So 360,000 fewer kids were kicked out of school last year as a result of this.
And I'll note that during the same time period, there was a massive realignment of the juvenile justice system, and most of the youth authority prisons were shut down.
I think that was a
contributor to this as well.
Yeah.
As we rethought some of our punishment systems for young people.
Right.
And I think that that's part of a nice progressive trend. Suzanne, you also point out that the Building Healthy Communities program discovered the presence of trauma, childhood trauma, in many young people in California. Take a minute to describe that.
Yeah, I mean, others had been working on this, but they began to realize, because again, hearing from the people in the communities, they began to understand you can't heal a community if there's a high level of trauma in the people in it, from domestic violence, from gang violence, from the trauma of not having enough food to eat, from excess school disciplines. And so there's so many forms of trauma, but they are now supporting, for example, and I have a chapter called Healing Trauma, and it opens up with a principal who adopted a whole child approach, where he doesn't ask what's wrong with you when a child misbehaves. He says, what is happening with you? And there's a scene in there I describe where a girl is throwing chairs around and utterly disrupting the classroom. And he came in and said, look, don't worry about this. We can clean this up. What's happening with you? And you can imagine any other scenario. She'd be dragged out, police called possibly, and sent home or to juvenile hall, what have you. And then her future would be severely, you know, damaged. Mm-hmm. And instead, he took her around, he walked her around the campus and said, look, you know, what's happening? And tell you what, if you ever feel like that again, put your hand up and say, I want to talk to Mr. Higa. And she agreed to do that. And 2 weeks later, she came to him and said, I'm not doing that anymore. And she never did. Huh. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing where you act compassionately. Suspensions have gone to zero in that school.
Mm-hmm.
And teachers love the environment. They wouldn't accept anything other than that now because it's a much easier place to work.
I don't have time to tell my story about being suspended in high school. But
I'm shocked.
It was a teacher who wasn't listening.
Of course. It was their fault.
Now, City Heights is this majority-minority community mm-hmm. in San Diego. I think it's 12% Caucasian.
Yeah, right.
And mm-hmm. it is it was largely ignored by the powers that be. They weren't investing in it. And you described this group of skaters, skateboarders, who really wanted a park, really, really, really.
Yes.
And we don't have time for the full story.
Right.
But what really grabbed me was along the way, they decided to hold candidate forums. And they invited candidates for San Diego City Council to come and talk to them. And they presented their demand. You know, mm-hmm. they want a skateboard park and right. we've got a place for it. We just need money.
Mm-hmm.
And they got candidates to pledge that mm-hmm. if they're elected, they'll support it. And I just thought this a really creative, resourceful way that they found their power.
Right. Exactly. And again, how they did it was a community group in the area hired a youth organizer and convened these kids, and then they'd have stacks of pizza for them, so they'd have a lunch, you know, a nice dinner for them, and then also trained them on how to be a community organizer. One remembered a class on power analysis, how to understand the power structure in your community, and then how to respectfully go at creating change. And so they're trained in respectfully interacting, doing quality research, and they went to something like 150 city meetings, planning departments, city council, and so on. And in the end, they got one small plaza, and just last January, a 19,000 square foot plaza opened up. They brought in about $6 million in funding.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is they won the hearts of the city council. They loved the determination of these kids and this organized way they went about it. And they got the support of staff and the council, and they got these grants in to make it happen.
And I want to stress that the work that you detail in the book is not exclusively focused at minority communities. When you look at Del Norte County and mm-hmm. Crescent City in mm-hmm. particular, mm-hmm. they discovered that there was a kindergarten dropout problem.
Right, right.
Or what's more accurate is that 30% of the kindergarten population was chronically absent,
right.
probably due to their parents' workload mm-hmm. and travel and limited access to childcare.
Right.
But what is shown that is so dramatic is that in a 3-year period, by promoting reading of parents to their children,
uh-huh.
the readiness for kindergarten jumped from 33% to 62%.
Right.
And at first, they tried a kind of top-down approach. We're going to communicate more with the public, and we're going to hire some tutors. And that was a flat-out failure.
Total, yeah. Yes, and so what they did is a very empathic deep dive into, and this is all ultimately about improving literacy, because they, like so many rural areas, are economically distressed, and you have to have entrepreneurs able to start new businesses. So they realized, and they were not getting quality, workers there,
mm-hmm.
people lacking professional skills and literacy. So, yes, and what they've done is when they went to their homes to try to understand the obstacles to learning, and we don't have time to go into the whole detail of it, but it's really making the needle move
yeah.
on literacy in that county, and there's certainly lessons nationwide for that.
So the Cal Endowment invested about $1 billion in a 10-year program.
Right, and they're still in the midst of it. It's now year 8.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to continue it. It's been so successful, another 10 years.
So they'll be investing another $1 billion? Or have
that's
they
what they're
committed
saying. Yeah,
to that?
Probably. I mean, I have. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have to see them in writing say the exact amount, but they are planning on continuing this because it's why quit? It's working.
Yeah, Suzanne Bowen from right here in Marin County. The new book is 20 Years of Life: Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequality. Thanks so much for being with
us today. You're very welcome. Great talk, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with journalist Suzanne Bowen. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.